Grace and peace be with you. Well, the plan was not for me to preach today. The plan originally was that I wanted to come and say thank you. I called Dell and said, can I come down and thank the congregation and thank you for the ministry of sheltering that you were doing these many weeks? So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. On behalf of the people whose lives were transformed because of your willingness to open this space and your hearts to them, thank you. For all of the hard work and exhaustion you netted from that, thank you. Thank you. Congregation, thank you. Pastor Dell, for your leadership in that effort, thank you. Well done. But as long as I was coming, Dell said, well, do you want to preach? And so I looked at the text before I gave her the answer and said, oh, yeah, I've done that one before. Sure. And then a sermon that I had not done before has come. So before I start the message, let me offer a couple disclaimers. We're going to talk about grace and hospitality, and sometimes sermons are to call people into doing something that they have not been doing. And I don't want you to hear that today. Because sometimes sermons are to explain why we are doing what we're doing. And that's how I want you to hear this text today. This is the why of what has happened here in ministry in one way. The second disclaimer I need to offer is to just simply acknowledge that in any given congregation there are people who struggle with addiction, particularly addiction to alcohol. And this text is all about wine. And I've got to deal with it. And we've got to talk about it. But I don't want to do that without first acknowledging that sometimes it's hard to handle wine. And for some people, it's really tough. And I don't want these words to cause you surprise pain because we talk about wine. So just hold that for just a second and know that in preparing for our time together, you got some prayers from me, if that's you. Well, let's start, okay? Clean water. That was really tough to come by in Jesus' day. And the climate was such that you needed hydration. You had to have something to drink. And at wedding feasts in Jesus' day, there were a lot of guests. You would invite the town, not just your friends, and maybe the next town, because you had friends there too. And they lasted for a long time, a week. So a failure to have enough wine, lacking enough wine at a wedding feast in Jesus' day, was a tremendous failure in hospitality. It would bring shame on a family, on the wedding hosts, on the bride and groom, that was nearly impossible to overcome. Was it the poverty of the family? Did they just not have enough money to be able to buy enough? I don't know. I do know that at weddings, guests were supposed to bring stuff. It was like a potluck. You brought gifts for the bride and groom that included a few dishes to share, and a few bottles to share, so that everybody had enough. Was the lack of wine a sign that this family was somehow cut off from community? That they didn't have a support network or friends? And what would that have been about? I'm not sure. But don't fear. It has a happy ending. And we know that from the very first words of the text. 3 days later. Now, this was a story that was written to people who already knew the end of the story about Jesus. 3 days ring any bells for you? It was John's signal that something about the story was going to have a new life component. So we know we're going to have a happy ending even in the midst of this terrible, terrible situation. The very first words of the story point us there. So you know the details. Mary, Jesus' mother, sees the need and calls Jesus to act. And the result was the very best wine. in quantities that would make a sommelier squeal with joy. The music plays and the dancing continues, and everything was made right. Now, John's gospel is like fine wine. My one daughter and her husband lived near Sonoma for a while. They were stationed at Travis Air Force Base. And so my first trip there, we had to go to Sonoma. And we got a little course when we got to the first winery on how to taste wine. Have you ever had a course on how to taste wine? Okay, all right. So if you want to, you can do it with me. You take your glass and you swirl. And then you get the bouquet. Just to wake everything up in your head, something good's about to happen. And then he said you take a little sip, just a little swip, and you swish it around. You're not trying to taste it. Just wake up all the taste buds in the front and the back and on the sides so that your mouth knows, oh, this is going to be a really good experience. And then you take a second sip. And that's to start contemplating the flavor. And you think about what it tastes like. And then the third sip, that's really what the wine tastes like. But if you don't do the other stuff, the third sip isn't going to be a good third sip. There are layers in this story, and we're going to take some sips. And I'm not sure which sip you might get caught up in, but whatever sip it is, go with it, right? That's the spirit. Go with it. The first sip might be, or the swirling in the okay, just maybe hearing the story. Hearing the story. Okay. We know what's coming. And then that first sip usually is focusing on water turned to wine. The miracle. Right? Isn't that how we refer to the whole story? Jesus turned water to wine. That second sip, that's more like that response Jesus gives to his mom. My time has not yet come. In the original languages, Mary's name isn't used. It's just Jesus' mother in the gospel. She doesn't show up again until John says she was standing at the foot of the cross. His time had come. And then there's that third sip. For me, that third sip, the real flavor of the story and all of its nuances and fullness, have something to do with John 1:17. Where we're told the whole purpose of what's going on in this gospel is to reveal God's grace upon grace to humanity. That there is grace upon grace to be had from God. Carolyn Lewis is one of my favorite commentators, and as I was studying the passage, she writes, abundance, as it turns out, and that's really what grace is, an experience of the abundance of God. Abundance, as it turns out, is never just about you and Jesus alone. As much as we want it to be that way, hope that it will be that way, but it's about bringing us into relationships. When we're once rejected, we're brought into community. When we're once abandoned, we're brought to true life, abundant life, Jesus says in chapter 10, verse 10 of this gospel. His purpose was to give us rich and satisfying life. Abundance can never be individualized. It's always a community affair. From the very beginning of God's promises to make things right again in the world, God's promise was for everyone, peoples and nations, not just for individuals. God's plan in the world was for beloved community. Not for beloved individuality, for the common good, not just for my good. From the beginning of this story, the author wants us to remember God's global perspective on salvation, because Jesus has made his home not in Judea, but in Gentile territory. His adult home, and where he performs this very first sign, is in Galilee. From the very beginning in John, Jesus is a transnational figure. His life and work go beyond the boundaries of race and nation. Carolyn Lewis continues, it's not just that abundance is yours to keep, it's that abundance reorients our way of being in the world. Abundance cannot be realized unless it's experienced in relationship with others and with God. And so she asked the question, what does abundant grace taste like? Well, it tastes like wine that was water at a wedding feast in Cana of Galilee. Like the best wine. Because Jesus is the source of the grace that brought it into being. It's one thing to taste the grace of God for ourselves. Have you tasted it? It's quite another thing to give somebody else a taste of the grace of God. Maybe that's the deepest sip of all. I'm not sure it was very convenient for Jesus to have his mother say, do something about it. But his hosts needed assistance and the other guests needed something to drink. And so she says, hey, they don't have any more wine. I can almost see it. Jesus says the very non-codependent thing. So how's that my problem? And his mother gives him the look. You know the look. The look is all about, look, kid, I raised you better than that. You better get with the program and get with it fast. Look. Jesus acts. And salvation comes to the house. Salvation comes to the house. Not the go to heaven, get saved kind of salvation, but the salvation that spared them from the humiliation and shame of culture's worst sin, inhospitality. Grace and hospitality are primarily about relationships restored. It is Martin Luther King weekend, and so any good congregation in the United Church of Christ would expect the pastor to mention Dr. Martin Luther King. And I knew you would be thinking that. And I wondered, what does Dr. King say about grace? Before I got there, there was an article written in 2018 by Jonathan Darman, titled The Persistence of Grace, in which he describes King's life. Listen, his accomplishments were extraordinary. His failings were ordinary and human. He was perpetually late. He struggled endlessly to keep his weight down. So far, Dr. King and I have a lot in common. He was capable of vanity, jealousy, deception. He was chronically unfaithful to his wife. To the world, he showed unimaginable, unbreakable courage through years of death threats, arrests, and persecution. In private, he nursed profound doubts. Darman described King's life as a persistent exercise of God's grace experienced personally and shared publicly through his extraordinary ministry. Grace isn't ours to possess, you see, but ours to experience and then share. It is not a doctrine to be believed, but a way of being in the world. In a sermon Dr. King preached sometime between 1954 and 1960, according to the file folder in which the manuscript was found, he wrote, now the grace of God is not just some passing phrase, not just some old concept that we should be ashamed to use now. It's not just some mechanical concept that has no deep meaning. Grace has a very vital place in any life. It has a vital place in understanding the whole predicament of humanity and the whole predicament of the universe. For you can never understand life until you understand the meaning of the grace of God. The whole of life hinges on the ever-flowing power and ever-flowing stream of God's grace. Hospitality is one of the ways God's grace is incarnated in the world. I happen to remember that the first action in Mark is an exorcism, cast out those demons. And the first action of Jesus in ministry in Matthew is the Sermon on the Mount, teach character. And the first action of Jesus in Luke is preaching and good exegesis of the scriptures in the synagogue in his hometown. But for John, the first action of Jesus is going to a wedding and saving the hosts from the embarrassment of inhospitality. If this story, being the first in John's gospel, means anything at all, it signals that hospitality, the embodiment of God's abundance, is the primary vehicle for delivering God's grace in the world. Salvation is as much about our saving other people in their not enough moments as it is in their need to get to heaven moments. That's the opportunity that we've been dealing with in the conference. I've been in a series of meetings, I can't tell you how many meetings, with ICE officials, local ICE officials, national ICE officials, with partners across the national and local spectrum who are engaged in refugee resettlement, and we're all talking about how to do better with the migrant crisis, humanitarian crisis that we're facing. This text has something to say about that. At the end of the story, we read the miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. What we do in moments when we are called to listen to that voice from Jesus' mother, they don't have enough. What we do in the moment when that voice says, listen to him, do what he tells you. Those are the moments that we're closest to that deep drink of God's grace. The moment when we share what it tastes like with other people. God's grace and abundance enter human experience, and everyone gets a taste of the best possible life. Mary Oliver, in one of her poems, puts it this way. You can have the other words, chance, luck, coincidence, serendipity. I'll take grace. I don't know what it is exactly, but I'll take it.